The last case this morning is number 034006, Cato against Thompson.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, my name is Kevin Bezetny, counsel on behalf of the plaintiff appellant Fannie Mae Cato. The issue before this Court this morning is whether the trial court erred in denying the plaintiff's motion to vacate summary judgment. We contend that, yes, it did error, and it was an abuse of discretion for the Court to do that. This case involves the November 5, 2000 death of Wardell Cato, Jr. The lawsuit filed in the Central District of Illinois was filed on November 5, 2001, and it involves Wardell's death at approximately 5:20 a.m. on November 5, 2000. This action was brought as a wrongful death, a survival, and a Section 1983 action against Jim Thompson, Richard Morris, Jason Morton, and Russell Lee Hunt. The pertinent facts with regard to the procedural history of the case were that on April 8, 2002, the amended pleading discovery plan was approved by the district court. Pursuant to that plan, on July 1, 2003, all discovery was to be completed. On August 22, 2003, just prior to that, following the discovery closure, the defendants moved for summary judgment supported by the deposition of the attending emergency room doctor, Dr. Krug. The response to that motion, the deadline for the response to that motion was August 22, 2003. On August 28th, having not received a response to the motion, the district court granted, pursuant to its local rule 7.1, granted the defendant's motion for summary judgment, based upon the fact that no response had been filed. On September 12, 2003, I filed a motion to vacate that decision based upon both Rule 59E and Rule 60B. I explained through my own affidavit that during the period of time when this case was proceeding, that the responsibility for it had been assigned to others in my firm based upon my very, very heavy, at the time, case and trial schedule, which included the preparation of six separate major cases which were sent to trial beginning in October of 2002 through September of 2003. During this period of time, I assumed incorrectly that the responsibility for this case had been handled, that discovery was ongoing, and the case was being managed accurately. I was mistaken. Upon receipt of the district court's ruling, I immediately prepared the motion to vacate. I outlined for the district court the discovery that was necessary in order to proceed with the case and, more importantly, to respond to the motion for summary judgment. The district court denied the motion, and we contend before this court that its denial was an abuse of discretion. We pointed out two separate rules under which the motion, we contend the district court abused its discretion, both Rule 60B1 and 2 and 6, as well as Rule 59E. With regard to Rule 60B, it is clear that the district court may relieve a party of a final order or mistake, inadvertence, surprise, or inexcusable neglect. And we outlined through the motion to vacate and through my own affidavit what we contend was inexcusable neglect. That motion was left to the sound discretion of the trial court. The trial court denied that motion. We also pointed out that the motion could have been granted under Rule 60B6, which is a fallback or safe harbor provision which allows the district court to provide relief when it's unavailable under other aspects of Rule 60B. We felt as though, based upon the circumstances, the very unusual circumstances of my personal trial schedule and my assumption that the matter was being handled by other counsel in my office, that that would be sufficient or was sufficient to justify and allow the court to vacate the summary judgment. We were mistaken. We believe that, based upon all of the information that was before the trial court, that it had sufficient basis, it had sufficient information upon which to vacate the granting of summary judgment. effectively what the court did was to grant summary judgment based upon application of its own local rule, which I agree the courts do need to have local rules in place for the management of its cases. But this was a motion for summary judgment. The court simply, summarily, based upon application of its rule, granted the summary judgment without consideration, without analysis of the facts and circumstances in support of the motion for summary judgment. We sought in the motion to vacate, which was supported by my affidavit, an affidavit that was not controverted, to vacate the summary judgment, to allow us to proceed with limited discovery, and to file a response to the motion for summary judgment. We believe that the trial court had within its discretion the ability to grant us that relief, and we believe that its failure to do so was most respectfully an abuse of discretion. Finally, obviously I'm not at all happy to be here this morning. I'm embarrassed about what has taken place. I'm embarrassed about the result. But based upon the consequence, we believe that the application of Local Rule 7.1 was an extreme and harsh result under the circumstances. It is very unusual for a trial attorney to be engaged in the preparation for six major trials in a back-to-back period of time, in addition to handling other things. And I have no other excuse other than the fact that, based upon this trial schedule, it was something that was left to others within my firm, and that was a mistake. But we believe that based upon the totality of the circumstances, this court has the discretion and warranted to vacate the motion for summary judgment, allow the limited discovery to proceed, and to allow us to take and file a motion for summary judgment so that this case can be decided on the merits as opposed to the application of Local Rule 7.1.
Did you ever offer to pay all attorneys' fees and expenses incurred by the other side?
I believe in our brief, Your Honor, we did point out that that would have been within the trial court's...
Did you offer? The trial court could have permitted reinstatement, vacating the order on condition that you do that, but did you ever come in and offer to do it?
I don't believe it was part of the motion to vacate, Your Honor, no.
Why not?
Quite frankly, based upon what at that period of time was these six back-to-back major trials, I felt as though, again, in error, that would have been sufficient as an explanation. This was not a disregard for the trial court or for counsel or anyone. Had I felt as though that was necessary, I certainly would have.
Well, see, a district judge would look a lot more favorably on a request for relief in a situation like this if you offered to compensate the other side for all the time and expense it put into the case would have to be redone if your neglect was found to be excusable.
I understand your position, Your Honor. That was not made part of our motion, but I certainly understand. And as I said in our brief, that certainly would have been within the trial court's discretion, and I would not have had any problem with that. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from Mr. Alcorn now.
Good morning. My name is Dan Alcorn, and I represent the defendant appellees in this matter. May it please the court, counsel. Plaintiff asserts three different rules in support of its argument that that Judge Gorman, the trial court in this matter, erred in not vacating its summary judgment order. The first rule cited is Rule 59E. And in our brief, we point out that in this circuit, there's a bright-line rule when addressing, analyzing post-judgment, substantive post-judgment motions of this sort, that when the motion is filed within 10 days of the order being attacked, this court uses Rule 59E. Under Rule 59E, there are basically three bases for the court to vacate or reconsider its order. One is new evidence. One is new facts. The third is a manifest error on the part of the trial court. We would submit that the plaintiff has come forward with no grounds to establish the existence of any of those circumstances. The plaintiff does argue there was a manifest error. The plaintiff argues that the manifest error was that of her counsel. we would submit that Rule 59E, the standard under that rule, does not allow for the court to reconsider under Rule 59E its prior order based upon a manifest error of the parties or the parties' counsel. Nevertheless, the trial court, in its very thorough and well-reasoned decision in this matter, did explore the issue of Rule 60, Rule 60B, which was the basis for the plaintiff's argument that there was inexcusable or that there was excusable neglect on the part of plaintiff's counsel in handling this case. The court very correctly noted that the standard is whether or not the obvious and admitted neglect on the part of plaintiff's counsel was excusable or not. And in deciding that, the court looked at all of the facts and circumstances that the plaintiff came forward with and discussed those. The court was looking to see whether or not there was any diligence on the part of the plaintiff and the plaintiff's counsel in handling this case. I understand and am sympathetic with counsel's sense of embarrassment at being before this court on this issue, and I'm sympathetic with that. One thinks, there but for the grace of God go I in circumstances such as this. But when one looks at the circumstances of this case, it's not one of those situations. This is a situation where the parties agreed to a 15-month discovery schedule. The discovery cutoff was set. The dispositive motions deadline was set. The pretrial hearing was set. And the jury trial was scheduled, all by agreement in April of 2002. 15 months went by, and the plaintiff conducted not one iota of discovery.
There were a few sort of wake-up call opportunities during that time frame, were there not, in the form of motions to compel, discovery, and so forth?
Unfortunately, that's true, Your Honor. Not only did the plaintiff not affirmatively conduct discovery, but they weren't forthcoming in response to the defendant's attempts at discovery. In fact, they didn't even provide their Rule 26A disclosures on time. We had to file a motion to compel after repeated requests that they do that, and it was only on the eve of the hearing on the motion to compel that they did so. We also ran into some trouble in receiving subpoenaed documents from the healthcare institutions that treated the plaintiff's decedent. They refused to give documents without the plaintiff's consent, and so we requested that the plaintiff provide us with that, and 9 months went by. 9 months went by. Our requests weren't heeded. We had to file a motion to compel on that, and it was, again, only on the heels or only on the verge of the trial court ruling on our motion to compel that we got that cooperation. So it wasn't like this thing just went into a vacuum for 15 months. We were out there conducting discovery. We took the plaintiff's deposition. We took the deposition of the treating physician, Dr. Krug, who dealt who destroyed plaintiff's case. And at that point, nothing. We didn't hear anything from the plaintiffs from that point on. And so when the dispositive motions deadline came, we filed our motion for summary judgment. We had a very, very strong case, and I think the statement of facts in my brief shows just how devastatingly strong the defense case was. There was simply no evidence at all of deliberate indifference or causation, and there was no response filed. The trial court looked at the motion, found that it was admitted, found all the facts uncontested and in our favor, and on that basis found there was no basis to establish a genuine issue of material fact on causation or deliberate indifference, and granted summary judgment. 4 years after Mr. Cato's death, 4 years, November is a very important date in this case. It's when Mr. Cato unfortunately died, it's when the case was filed, it's when the notice of appeal was filed, and it's when we're appearing before this court. 4 years after his death, plaintiffs have been unable to come up with one witness statement, one expert to support the theory of their case. They didn't investigate it before they filed it. They didn't conduct any discovery. and they didn't even bother to respond to our motion for summary judgment. That is inattentiveness. That is not excusable neglect. It's a complete abandonment of the case. The standard of review is would any reasonable person agree with Judge Gorman that that is not excusable? We would submit, Your Honor, that the case be affirmed. And absent any questions, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Halcorn. Thank you.
Your Honors, I have great difficulty arguing in contrast to many of the statements that counsel stated and has made. As I indicated before and as I laid out before the district court, this was an unusual period of time in my practice and in my firm. I was engaged in several cases at the same time, back to back to back, and the responsibility, the day-to-day handling of this matter fell upon other attorneys. I think that if you read the cases that allow for relief or deny relief under Rule 60, you're not going to find any instance, any case, that has the same or similar facts as what we have here. This is a situation where, quite literally, from October until September of 2003, I was engaged in preparation. Actually, the trials began at that period of time, back to back to back. And the time before that was spent in preparation for these considerable trials. Am I embarrassed? Yes. Am I apologetic? Yes. Do I want the court in its discretion to vacate the summary judgment? Yes. I believe it is warranted under the circumstances as presented by this case. It may not create a bright line test for all cases, but I believe that based upon the facts in this case, the circumstances do warrant granting the relief, and I respectfully submit that the trial court abused its discretion in denying that. Thank you.
Our thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. We have concluded the call of the morning. Therefore, the court will rise until 9:30 tomorrow.